You're listening to a program produced in 2017 by Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place at the historic Central Library in downtown Los Angeles. Aloud is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To learn more, please visit lfla.org/aloud. Who gets to see Shakespeare and act in his plays? What does the master mean to us in 2017, and what is our deep and early connection to the Bard? In the exhibition, which I hope you've all visited upstairs in our Getty Gallery, America's Shakespeare, The Bard Goes West, we learn how Shakespeare inspired presidents and incited mobs. We learn that Shakespeare was applied to our national bereavement at the moment of Lincoln's assassination, that the great actor Paul Robeson performed Othello throughout segregated America in the 40s, that a Russian Jewish immigrant performed Shylock in Yiddish on Broadway, that Shakespeare's play Henry V was issued to U.S. troops in 2002 on the heels of the Iraq War. How does one Englishman's imagination still sit within the consciousness of our country today? Tonight, we will listen in on two Shakespeare experts, Lisa Volpe and James Shapiro, who will consider how and why Shakespeare still matters in contemporary America. James Shapiro is the Larry Miller Professor of English at Columbia University. He's the author of numerous books and essays on Shakespeare, including his most recent book, The Year of Lear, Shakespeare in 1606. He's also the editor of Shakespeare in America, an anthology from the Revolution to Now, and Shakespeare and the Jews, recently republished in a 20th anniversary edition. Professor Shapiro is the recipient of many honors. He is the Shakespeare Scholar in Residence at New York's Public Theater. And Lisa Volpe is an award-winning actress, director, teacher, and playwright, and the artistic director and founder of the Los Angeles Women's Shakespeare Company, an award-winning, all-female, multicultural theater company, which she founded in 1993. She's played Iago in Othello, Shylock in Merchant of Venice, Leontes in The Winter's Tale and Prince Hamlet, among other roles. And she's the creator of a solo show, Shakespeare and the Alchemy of Gender, which she's toured extensively, which details the journey of her exploration as an actor through gender-bending turns within Shakespeare's greatest roles, drawing on events in her own family's history. So you're in for a treat. We will start with Shakespeare in Today's America. Thank you.
He jests at scars that never felt a wound, but soft. What light through yonder window breaks? It is the east, and Juliet is the sun. Arise, fair sun, and kill the envious moon, who is already sick and pale with grief, that thou, her maid, art far more fair than she. Be not her maid, since she is envious. Her vestal livery is but sick and green, and none but fools do wear it. Cast it off. Oh, it is my lady. Oh, it is my love. Oh, that she knew she were. She speaks, yet she says nothing. What of that? Her eye discourses. I will answer it. I am too bold. It is not to me she speaks. Two of the fairest stars in all the heavens, having some business, do entreat her eyes to twinkle in their spheres till they return. What if her eyes were there, they in her head? The brightness of her cheek would shame those stars as daylight doth a lamp. Her eye in heaven would through the airy region stream so bright that birds would sing and think it were not night. See how she leans her cheek upon her hand.
That's great, that's great.
Thank you, sir.
Hello. I'm Lisa, that was Romeo. And this is Professor Shapiro, the most famous man in the world.
Hardly. Just call me Jim, and I've come a long way to hear Lisa do Shakespeare, and not just Shakespeare, but roles in Shakespeare that have largely been denied to women, although of late that seems to be changing. Why do you think that's changing now? Harriet Walters doing Prospero in New York. This seems your company has been doing this for a very long time. But something has shifted in the culture a bit. And I'm just curious, since you have been...
There's
really
a pushback. I mean, obviously playing Hamlet was a really great hallmark of artistry for women for many hundreds, for a long, long time. And then it went out of fashion to support women doing anything. So there's a pushback. And some of us here in the audience created the LA Women's Shakespeare Company. We went to all the libraries and we performed and we, you know, we built a company. And I've been touring internationally. We were featured on CNN twice and on PBS and NBC News. We built a lot of grassroots support. But I think it's the time for empowered women to start taking the stage. The numbers actually haven't changed, strangely enough. I actually brought some statistics, which I thought were interesting.
Good.
And you and I were talking about Melissa McCarthy playing Spicy.
Yes. Which, and hope,
you know what?
It's every been... Saturday she's going to continue to...
And her friends are coming. All the girls are coming.
You know,
and it's very... I just want to read this one quote.
And I want to get back to her.
Well, we could get back to her right now.
I'm just saying that I never understood the power of cross-dressing in Shakespeare until I saw her Spicer imitation. And, you know, I've, like many of you, have seen a lot of male actors play female roles, and including some great, great actors. But there was something about the brilliance of that literal pushback in that scene, which clearly drove the president crazy. And showed you what it means for a woman to take over a man's role in a certain way. And it was just an extraordinary moment, I think, for the nation.
The moment of taking the podium and smashing people.
I loved it.
This is what all the girls experience on airplanes when they try to sit in a seat. You know, just man spread. Do you know what I mean?
I do.
And that sociopolitical space that we take up when we play Hamlet or Iago isn't quite as political as Sean Spicer in the hands of Melissa McCarthy.
Yeah.
So I think it's a really great example of what the power of stepping across the boundary is and embodying the other and saying, this is how I see it when you come out and you lie to all of us. Do you know what I mean? It feels aggressive, like you're taking up my truth space.
And when you have a group of people, men and women in this administration, so obsessed with dressing like a woman and what roles are that are stable, once you start ripping that down, it's the Wizard of Oz and the curtain is pulled back. So it's really thrilling for me. The other thing that's thrilling for me is listening to Lisa do Romeo. There's a suppressed or repressed or forgotten history in this country of women doing exactly what you did. And my favorite example is Charlotte Cushman, whose name I'd never heard of 5 years ago, who decided she wanted not to play Juliet, she wanted to play Romeo. And there was pushback against that. And she persuaded her sister to play Juliet so that it didn't seem like a woman was doubly transgressing by playing a male role and making love to a woman on stage.
And off stage. She was a huge lesbian.
Well, she was. She was. She started with her sister, then she moved to Juliet's
Warren. She never slept with her sister.
She never did. Her sister had an abusive husband, so that was the fig leaf. And her Romeo, her Juliet kept getting younger and better looking as time went on. And she was playing, I think, in Philadelphia, and somebody, some guy in the audience, snorted when she was doing that very scene. She stopped, came to the front of the stage, and called him out. Like, and she was intimidating, as you are. And The guy left the theater. It was a great moment. So that was, you know, over, that was in the 1840s and 50s. So there is a long tradition. It tends to not be taught in college classrooms. And you are in a position of reinventing the wheel, it seems, and carrying a fight that has been fought by talented actors for a long time in this country.
Well, you know, you think you're done. And then I went to the Shakespeare conference last week, and a gentleman showed me what he thought was funny, which was make Shakespeare great again. And I said, I don't think it's funny. And he said, well, all my colleagues voted for Trump, and I'm just going to float this out here. And I said, I will fight you, because I just spent 25 years working on inclusivity for people of color and women to share the stage with men. And we're not going back. We're really tired of this fight. This is a stupid fight. But I have to keep working. I mean, I literally just closed my company December 31st because I was fairly sure that President Clinton would have it all under her wingspan. And I never thought we'd go back 50 years, do you know what I mean? But I have been touring in the South, teaching and directing and touring in Virginia and Indiana and Florida enough to know that this was not a surprise. This election was not a surprise. None of us live in a bubble, but some of us live in California where we have, you know, a different experience than the rest of the country. And when I'm not in L.A., I'm in New York. Or I'm in London or somewhere that's pretty advanced. But even two or three years ago, I directed the first all-female Shakespeare ever done in Canada. So this is all really new to some people. And if I'm in Indiana doing a Q&A, they'll say, how could that even work? Whereas if you're in New York or L.A., you've already seen cross-gender Shakespeare a lot.
Right.
Reverse gender Shakespeare. You know, adaptations of Shakespeare. I was just in the Pericles that was rewritten Shakespeare. So there's all kinds of things being done with Shakespeare. And, you know, the Globe just toured every country in the world. But
does it feel like the work has more urgency now than it might have a year ago?
I've been devastated by the election results. I don't know how many artists out there are devastated, but most of my friends, as I said to you just recently, have insomnia, and we don't know. And, you know, if you take the NEA away, many companies will close. L.A. just saw the equity shut down the 99-seat theater movement. That's 350 theaters in Los Angeles that are going to close.
That's terrible.
Because they want us to pay rehearsal wages of at least minimum wage when we can't sell a $20 ticket, and we always give our tickets away. So that's a lot of school children that won't see those productions. All these theater lovers won't see our little... Hi!
I want statistics. Give me statistics.
Look at these horrible statistics. What fun. 80% of what you will hear on an American stage will come out of the mouths of a man. 80% of the lines go to men. The ratio of male to female characters in film has been the same since 1946. Only 17% female characters. Now, Shakespeare was written for an all-male company, so comparing the male and female roles doesn't make any sense. It was more a question of the masters and the apprentices. The older actors played the men, and the younger actors played the females. But if you look at Shakespeare, in the 38 plays, you have 826 male roles, 155 named female characters, and they're aggressively age-specific. So it's really only 16% female characters. So imagine what we gain if we can play the whole canon as the men did in their time. I mean, I could go on, but it's really hard because, you know, it's just dominated by white male playwrights anyway. We obviously don't actually know who wrote Shakespeare. But 82% of playwrights in the United States are white men. 3.4% are American women of color. So if you ask me why I'm an advocate for women of color and women in general, it's because they don't have very many jobs. The jobs are about a third of the set designers, a quarter of the sound designers, almost no lighting designers, 72% of stage managers are women, a higher percentage of costumers. Of the 30 new productions on Broadway, 6 are now being directed by women. Off-Broadway, the numbers have climbed from 2011 when we had 22% female directors to 40% in 2014. And then interestingly, we see the numbers start to go down again. So people think it's a gimmick and they get invested for a short amount of time in cross-gender Shakespeare. I'm involved in mentorship, research, outreach. And I just wanted to read you this little quote from Terry Power's book. Many gender scholars argue that gender is not a fixed category, and its prescriptive language, norms, and sets of behavior vary culturally and across eras. Cross-dressing has historically engendered anxieties in many societies, as it highlights the performative nature and fluidity of gender, serving to destabilize social structures, such as those found in Western patriarchal societies, and it also evokes deeply held anxieties towards the effeminization of society and men as a whole. This fear of the feminine is pervasive throughout many cultures and eras and manifests itself in strongly held suspicions that theater, the realm of cross-dressing and effeminized behavior, thoughts, and feelings, is a homosexual proving ground. This is clearly presented through scholarship in many studies on the topic of men and boy cross-dressing practices, but such anxieties seem to be currently manifesting in the reverse as women dress as men in contemporary Shakespearean productions. When women perform in roles traditionally played by male actors, they destabilize tightly held beliefs about male privilege, patriarchal positions of power, the performativity of masculinity, and the subversive nature of cross-dressing once again. So I just feel that politically, sexually, people get frightened much more when women take the male roles than the other way around, the way you said.
But, you know, I'm curious whether you think Glenda Jackson's playing King Lear just played King Lear in London, Harriet and others are involved in the UK and in St. Anne's in Brooklyn, in The Tempest and in other plays set in prisons with an all-woman cast, or almost all-woman cast. I think the barricades are coming down a little bit, and at least in the mainstream theater world of New York and London and L.A., where you've done such great work, that it's changing. I don't know if you feel that's
it is
a misapprehension.
I rewrote a chapter of a book I wrote for Charles Nay because I was so depressed 5 years ago that the big white guys would ever get out of their chairs. And then I had to rewrite it because there were gender-bent productions in every single company in the United States and also many in Europe. But that was not true 23 years ago when I first started lecturing.
Or even 15 years
ago, really. And my friends who've done it, like Vilma Silva, who played in Amanda Dehnert's Julius Caesar at Oregon Shakespeare Festival, or Harriet Walter, who obviously played in everything Phyllida directed. They're just not having that much success because they're not being supported the way the men are in similar roles. So I talked to Deborah Warner and her wife, and she said she would never play Richard II again because nobody gave her the space. Or Vilma Silva, when she was playing Julius Caesar at the Oregon Shakespeare Festival, after 25 years of playing every single actor's wife, supporting girlfriend, whore, and mother, they couldn't give her her Caesar. They would just steal the scene and give some backing to a very, very fine actress who was doing a great job. So it's competitive, and it's a rug-pulling thing. Mm-hmm. I see it a lot at the Shakespeare conferences during the drink discussions, when the boys go off and hire each other at midnight over scotch. And it's just so sad because for 23 years I've been doing all the keynote speeches on diversity and nothing is changing. We have 3 black people in the entire Shakespeare conference. Do you know what I mean? And it's sad because everybody says they want to do something. It's like, well, it can't be that nobody voted for Trump. You know, somebody actually didn't hire someone of color who knew a qualified person. And you and I were talking about the difficulty of the Equity Act. As I directed Othello recently, and they would not give me an equity line for Desdemona. They gave one to Brabantio. But they said a non-equity college girl can play Desdemona. The men have taken all 5 equity contracts. You can give one to Amelia because she's also in 3 other shows and directing one for $600 a week.
And the result is, from a Shakespeare scholar's point of view, and we won't name names of productions that disappointed us, but for 350 years, up through Robeson and beyond, Othello was a play about the relationship of Othello and Desdemona. And not knocking great actors who have played the roles of Iago and of Othello, but it is no longer that play.
Right.
It is now an Iago and Othello play. And I've seen some terrific actors, most recently in New York, do this. But when a Desdemona, who
is not compelling,
or is, doesn't have the same experience or is cast because she's 19 and looks good in a gym suit,
right,
as opposed to having the chops of the actors cast for Iago and Othello, it's going to be a disappointing production. I'm going to read two things from my anthology on Shakespeare in America, which is a subject I knew nothing about 5 or 6 years ago and have become obsessed with of late, and have my reaction, your reaction, is to the new administration. It's to double down and keep doing the extraordinary work you're doing. My task right now is to write a new book about Shakespeare in America, in a divided America, and try to understand how and why the kind of things that we didn't understand last November have been in this culture for a very long time. And obviously, because you're on the front lines, you've been feeling it every time you play Romeo or Hamlet or Ferdinand. But I'm discovering much of this, and I'd love to read to you the first of two things I'm going to read, and then I want to hear you perform again. But this comes from an essay on the character of Desdemona. And it was written in 1835 by the 6th president of the United States, John Quincy Adams, whose dad had been the 2nd president of the United States, and whose mom famously was Abigail Adams, a terrific and brilliant woman who herself had seen Sarah Siddons, one of the great, great actors in England, play in the late 18th century the role of Desdemona. John Quincy Adams, for those who are not familiar with his career, fought the Amistad case in support of blacks for the Supreme Court. He fought the gag rule in Congress. He was known in his day as one of the fiercest opponents of slavery. He was just a great abolitionist, the greatest one before Lincoln. That's the context for what I'm about to read to you, what he has to say about Desdemona. My objection to the character of Desdemona arises not from what Iago or Rodrigo or Brabantio or Othello says of her, but from what she herself does. She absconds from her father's house in the dead of night to marry a blackamoor. She breaks her father's heart and covers his noble house with shame to gratify what? Pure love, like that of Julietta Miranda? No, a natural passion. It cannot be named with delicacy. Her admirers now say this is the criticism of 1835, that the color of Othello has nothing to do with the passion of Desdemona. No? Why, if Othello had been white, what need would there have been for her running away with him? She could have made no better match. If the color of Othello was not as vital to the whole tragedy as the age of Juliet is to her character and destiny, then I have read Shakespeare in vain. And he goes on for about 10 pages to trash Desdemona for loving and marrying a black man. And this is an abolitionist. And you feel the ways in which racial exclusion and gendered exclusion are all underneath this.
Systematic racism and misogyny, yeah. Benjamin Franklin let his sister starve to death. He had lots of money. She had like 8 children and died in a poorhouse of starvation, I think. But anyway, yeah, I mean, you're right. It's terrible. When I was in Prague this summer, I saw an all-white production of Othello, all white people. And the man who played Othello painted himself in tiger stripes. And he sat astride a papier-mâché tiger. And the clown, which is often cut from Othello, was an obese white woman who rolled around muttering in the Czech language racist epithets, you N-word, you
son. Were they aware of it? Was it trying to undermine racial categories, or was it just oblivious?
It was staged in a fascistic way in a pistol range, in a border control station. And when Desdemona was throttled, she fell to the ground. No one ever touched her again. When Amelia was shot, nobody checked her pulse. Iago was never controlled at the end of the play.
So is this a feminist play, or is it oblivious to everything that's happened in the last
I'm saying
years?
This was a gay, white, Czech man's vision of how Othello should be done in 2017. Yeah. That it's a cold man's world and the women were dressed as whores and they didn't matter.
Interesting. I look at Othello as the great American play, which is to say that if you truly want to know what's happening in this country or what's wrong with this country, go to see a production of Othello, and it will tell you more than the New York Times, CNN, MSNBC, and Fox rolled up together.
Yeah.
And it is one of the reasons why we can't let the NEA and the NEH get shut down. And we need to keep producing plays to figure out what's roiling beneath the surface of our country.
Well, our friends are all working really hard to do that. Like Robert Schenken just wrote a play about the wall. Molly Smith is putting out 4 new political pieces on the Arena stage. You're doing... Talk about your Julius Caesar with Oscar Eustace.
It's now no longer embargoed, so I can talk about it. No, no, it's not embargoed, so it's good.
Talk about the other secrets.
No. It's, I work for the Public Theater in New York, and I have to say one of the great things about the Public Theater under Oscar Eustace is that Oscar is attentive to the need to not have every director as a white guy in his 50s. And he's been nurturing a lot of talent of younger artists, women, African-American. I'm working right now with a Nigerian-born Saheem Ali is his name, who's doing, yes, friend of Saheem's. Saheem's doing a great 12th night that's going to tour 17 prisons and then sit down at the Public Theater in March and April. And it's going to be a wet foot, dry foot production of 12th night with it coming from Cuba and landing in Miami in the 1990s. And it's going to be about immigration as much as anything else. But Oscar Eustace, who is the guy who runs the Public, has not directed in several years. And he's going to come back and at the Delacorte Theater in Central Park do a production of Julius Caesar, which will be a deeply, deeply political production. And I've been working with him on that. I can't tell you how exciting it is just to see Shakespeare with terrific actors. Alec Baldwin will not be playing. There was actually some thought about having Alec Baldwin play Trump, but I think Alec Baldwin wants to play Brutus, so that wouldn't work. But there are ways of understanding our culture and our country really through through these great works. And I took a stroll for an hour or so through that spectacular exhibit about 50 yards from where we're sitting now, Shakespeare in the West, which is thrilling. And you walk through those rooms and you realize it's a beautifully curated exhibition. I'm on the board of the Folger Library, so I shouldn't say that it's much better than the production, but it is much better than the exhibition that it grew out of that came from the Folger, in part because of the quality of the people who put together this exhibition, in part because there's a lot of really good Western stuff in this. And California has always been at the cutting edge of everything, including, as it turns out, and as that exhibition confirms, Shakespeare.
I have one quick Desdemona story.
I'm ready.
So we were doing Othello in 1994. And we were at the Odyssey Theater. Some of you may have been there. And Fran Bennett was playing Othello. And she was out in the parking lot in full regalia when O.J. Simpson's Bronco drove by down Sepulveda Boulevard.
You're making this up.
No, because we did talkbacks after every show for our first decade or so. And what was really interesting about that was that the audience then went on to this rant every night about why would Desdemona allow this? Because it's written that way, but, you know, but They had never questioned a black man slapping a woman upside of her head, but because it was a black woman playing a black man, they wow. thought for some reason that it could turn it into dialogue and listen to each other the way women do.
Wow.
Do you know what I mean?
Wow.
And it was this real attack on Nicole Simpson, like she should have done something about it. So it just reminded me of your story, because I thought, who are these people? What are you thinking? That was the story. They cannot look at the Christian, turn the other cheek. You know, the Christian thing is you can either look towards love or you can look towards fear, but you can't do both at the same time. So Desdemona looks towards love, which I think is a grace-filled aspiration.
That's beautiful. Yeah.
And you don't have to call her all the things you're...
Our former president did, yeah, yeah. Again, that's just another great example of how this play manages to keep speaking to us with terrific urgency. One of the things that the exhibition on Shakespeare in the West made me think a little bit about was who gets to actually speak Shakespeare. Because traditionally, somebody who's white and male originally got to speak it, and for most of the history of the plays. And there has been also a tradition until quite recently that somebody who might have my accent, my Brooklyn accent, would be disenfranchised from speaking Shakespeare. People who were of color, people who, you know, the first, to go back to Othello, the first American who played Othello was Ira Aldridge, but he could not play it in the United States. So he had to go to England and then to the continent, where he spent decades playing Othello and Shylock and other great roles. And it was only when the Civil War ended that he planned to come back to the United States and open at the Brooklyn Academy of Music. He died at that moment. And
this is the guy that Red Velvet was written about.
That's
this
right.
It's a beautiful play that's making this circuit now.
And it's a terrific play and a really sad story. And decades would then pass before Paul Robeson was the first to play that part on Broadway. And one of the things that the next time this exhibition is mounted in 100 years for Shakespeare's 500th anniversary here is, I'm going to do one more reading and then ask you to do something from Hamlet if
sure.
I could. And it is another Western story. It's another Californian story that's too little known. There is a wonderful short story writer named Toshio Mori, who died in 1980. And Toshio Mori wrote a short story either in 1939 or in 1945. It's unclear, and he's fudged it a bit. And I found this story published republished it in 1979 in a collection, and the story's called Japanese Hamlet. But it first appeared as Schoolboy Hamlet in local newspaper that was published in one of those camps that was set up for Japanese Americans from Oakland or California who were suspected during the war years of being fifth columnists. So he was sent to the Topaz Relocation Center, you know, for many, a concentration camp in which they were incarcerated. And while he was there, he wrote this terrific story. And it's a painful one that speaks to the subject we're discussing tonight, which is who gets to speak Shakespeare. And the story is only about 1,200 words long, but it's a very poignant one. And it's about a young Japanese American whose only desire in life and only ambition in life is to play Hamlet. And those of you who are old enough to remember the ways in which the Japanese Americans and the Japanese, the yellow peril, were represented in the 1940s and the 1950s in this country as, you know, yellow skin, buck tooth, exactly.
Just and caricatures played by white people, mostly.
Yes, exactly. So that's the context for the passage that I'll read. The name of the hero of this story is Tom Fukunaga, kind of half Anglo, half Japanese, and he can't quite manage both. And I'll read a paragraph spoken by the narrator, who's a friend of his, who can't understand why Tom is so deluded as to thinking he could ever play Hamlet on Broadway. When we came down to the business of recitation, there was no recess. Tom Fukunaga wanted none of it. He would place a cup of water before him and never touch it. "Tonight, we'll begin with Hamlet," he said many times during the years. Hamlet was his favorite play. When he talked about Shakespeare to anyone, he began by mentioning Hamlet. He played parts in other plays, but he always came back to Hamlet. This was his special role, the role which would establish him in Shakespearean history. And of course, the story ends sadly. Tom Fukunaga has no chance in the America of 1946 of playing Hamlet on Broadway. And you and I have both seen a lot of Hamlets. I have never seen an Asian American man or woman given a chance to play that role in a major production. So that there's all kinds of exclusivity and inclusivity. And one of the ways in which we can understand how far we've come as a country and as Americans is who gets to speak these words, whether it's a woman or a member of a minority group.
Well, we know that within 5 years, the United States will be more than 50% non-white people. And we know that theater audiences are aging out. And we know that we have thousands of more options for entertainment now than we once did. And that our attention spans are now down to 8 seconds.
Well, I hope it's longer because I'm going to ask you to, in the tradition of Tom Fukunaga, as somebody who until recently could not recite the words of Hamlet from a stage, could you give us something from Hamlet, if that's not too big an ask?
I'll do Hamlet, yeah. But the thing about it is I remember doing my solo show in Vancouver. It's a very personal piece where I talk about playing all these things that are taboo. And the 6.5-foot-tall Chinese man said, "I am you," in his broken English. He says, "I want to play Benedict. I don't want to play the Chinese man." Do you know what I mean? So we went out and we became friends. And I realized that they'd been working on the Caine Mutiny for 6 months with their in Mandarin and in English both to train themselves to gain purchase on the stage. But I think we have 3% Asian actors in America. So it's very unfair. To be or not to be, that is the question. Whether 'tis nobler in the mind to suffer the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune or to take arms against a sea of troubles and by opposing end them. To die. To sleep no more and by a sleep to say we end the heartache and the thousand natural shocks that flesh is heir to. 'Tis a consummation devoutly to be wished. To die. To sleep, to sleep, perchance to dream. Aye, there's the rub, for in that sleep of death, what dreams may come when we have shuffled off this mortal coil must give us pause. There's the respect that makes calamity of so long life. For who would bear the whips and scorns of time, the oppressor's wrong, the proud man's contumely, the pangs of disprized love, the law's delay, the insolence of office, and the spurns that patient merit of the unworthy takes when he himself might his quietus make with a bare bodkin. Who would these fardels bear? To grunt and sweat under a weary life, but that the dread of something after death, the undiscovered country from whose bourne no traveler returns, puzzles the will and makes us rather bear those ills we have than fly to others that we know not of. Thus conscience doth make cowards of us all. And thus the native hue of resolution is sicklied o'er with the pale cast of thought and enterprises of great pith and moment. With this regard, their currents turn awry and lose the name of action. Thank you. It's so famous.
How do you do that? I mean, in 1 minute, you're in the middle of a conversation. Another, you're in the middle of Hamlet. How do you manage that? That's extraordinary.
You want more Hamlet?
Yes.
What do you want? I can do another one. Okay, I'll do more Hamlet. Uh, What should I do? I'll do I could do that one. I could do Oh, are you host of heaven? Oh, earth, what else? And shall I couple hell or fire? Hold my heart, and you, my sinews, grow not instant old, but bear me stiffly up, remember thee. Yea. From the memory of... yea. What do I say next? What? What is it? God, I lost it. Yea, from the table of my memory I'll wipe away all trivial fond records, all saws of books, all forms, all pressures past that youth and observation copied there, and thy commandment all alone shall live within the book and volume of my brain unmixed with baser matter. Yes, yes, by heaven. O most pernicious woman, oh, villain, villain, smiling, damned villain! My tables, meet it is. I set it down that one may smile and be a villain. At least I'm sure it may be so in Denmark. So, uncle, there you are. Now to my word. It is adieu. Adieu. Remember me. I have sworn it. Sorry. Thank you. I mean, Hamlet's just a really great part. You get to explore a lot of things. I lost the line there. I didn't think I was going to do it.
As soon as you start doing it, that I forget or don't care that it's a man or a woman. You're just Hamlet.
The language goes beyond gender. I mean, imagine the boys first playing Juliet and Desdemona and Lavinia. And, you know, imagine the soul expansion. Imagine the self-revelation, the futility of asserting power when you know you could be on the other side of it. When I direct Reverse Gender, the Revengers tragedy, when the boys play the girls who are raped and the women play the rapists, the boys can't work. They have to stop rehearsal and go, I just want to punch her. Why can't I punch her? You cannot punch her. The script says you submit, you die, and your name is never said. You are just a vehicle so that the men can be heroic.
That's great.
And so that's a really interesting lesson because the boys will go on to dominate all the auditions and most of the work, because there's just a lot more women who want to be artists, I guess, nowadays. I mean, that goes to your first question. Why would women want to claim these roles? There are so many women who want to self-express, to attain power through language, to understand, to build empathy, which is the worst problem now. People are not feeling anymore. They can't feel their hearts. And if you do Shakespeare, that's the first thing you'll feel. I can. I love, I am. You know, it's all about your heartbeat.
And Hamlet is at the center of the canon for that. I got to work with an extraordinary Hamlet this past summer, Chuck Awuji, who is a black actor who wanted to play Hamlet. And he was a superstar for the Royal Shakespeare Company. He got to play Kings, English Kings, which was transgressive enough, and people were fainting from the idea of a black guy playing a medieval English king. But the moment almost passed for him to play Hamlet in his career. And Oscar Eustace invited him to play Hamlet for the prison Mobile Shakespeare. And I have very powerful memories of a hot August day this past summer in which it was a Black Lives Matter Hamlet. And there were 19 inmates on the roof of a federal prison in Brooklyn, and they were gathered there. We never force anybody to see it. It's only the ones who want to volunteer. And it was about 120 degrees on the roof that day. It was just burning hot. And the producer usually asks those in the audience who has seen a Shakespeare play before, and or a play, any play, and three hands went up out of the 19, and who has seen a Shakespeare play, and no hands went up. So we didn't have to say who has seen Hamlet. No one had seen Hamlet. And Chuck did that first speech that you did, the to be and not to be, and he took off his belt and tied off at a certain point, and, you know, the Bear Botkin was the decision to sleep or dream, and dream away one's life through drugs or not. And I looked around. I'd seen the production enough times, so all I cared about was watching the audience reactions. And I saw that these men who did not have the experience and the training that you all have, who had never heard these words spoken, got everything. And they were just, they weren't crying, because prisoners do not show emotion like that if they want to have a happy time when they go back from the production to their cells. But they were locked in. This was their world. And it underscores that it's not only who gets to speak the lines, as you just did brilliantly, but who gets to hear in this country these lines. So when you tell me that 99-seat theaters are, you know, that's where people get to see this stuff. So that's especially true.
And I must say, a lot of my friends and your friends work in the prisons. I've worked in the prisons. I've done Shylock with all these guys that are lifers.
Great.
We all did it together. They're doing the whole play with Kurt Tofteland out in Michigan. And Sabra Williams and Tim Robbins, they have a big program here, which is just changing lives, humanizing the prison system. And, you know, it's a very... Leslie Currier, I don't know if you saw it going around on Facebook, Leslie Currier and Marin Shakespeare, they just brought this young man out of the prisons who was playing Shakespeare in the prisons to his first job outside of the prison, was playing Othello with their company.
Wow.
A magnificent performance.
That's great.
Because if you want to get to the life and death stakes of what could language do for you, I used to work with Carol Gilligan, who did all the research on girls' child development. She was one of the co-artistic directors of Company of Women, which was an international all-female company that we had in the early 90s or 80s. But her husband, Jim Gilligan, he works on death row with serial killers. So he did a lot of the work that informed us about shame and why you would feel shame and then kill somebody to feel more powerful and then feel more shame and then kill again. What is that cycle? And, you know, when you're playing Richard III, that dovetails really nicely into actually feeling very powerful in the role.
That's great. We got to talk last week in New York and devour a lot of pastries as we did that. They were really good.
Chocolate rugula?
Oh, man. She kept buying more. It was dangerous.
He brought me there.
But when we'll get to talk again. But let's open this up to your questions for either of us or both of us so that we can make this a more open conversation with you. So if a hand goes up, we'll point to it. And a mic can be given to you. Why don't you just stand up and project? And
can you tell us a little bit, Mr. Shapiro, about Shakespeare in the 19th century America and how it might have been acted, how audiences might have expected it? You talked to the writer about Ida, the black actor who played Othello.
Ira Aldridge.
Ira Aldridge.
Grab the mic. It's right on your left hand there.
You never know who can't hear you.
He comes out and takes a bow after the third act. So what the audience was obviously very attuned to Shakespeare, how it was being played. Can you talk about that?
I can say that 19th century Shakespeare was really not like Shakespeare as we experience it. And I can open that up a little bit. But it would probably take me 5 years and we'd have to lock the doors to fully answer your question. And part of my way of answering the question is to refer you to that spectacular exhibition. I have never heard Paul Robeson recite Othello until this afternoon, and I've never heard Edwin Booth recite lines as it happens from Othello. I really hated the way Booth was reciting Othello. And that's because I live now. And his really...
I did listen to that. That was a little tinny.
It was tinny, but it was kind of rolling and not very... I mean...
Well, at the Globe, they have a lot of voices recorded. Have you all been to London and heard the exhibition's voices?
Yes.
So that's interesting. And I was a fellow at the Globe in the year 2000, so I got to stay there and look through everything and play on that stage for a month. And they showed us stuff like, did you know the original Othello played it in like a black leather S&M mask? And the original Romeo played it in a green beard because that symbolized youth. So a lot of the original practices they don't do now because they'd be so confusing to us. We wouldn't quite understand what they mean.
And the 19th century Shakespeare was different in a lot of ways.
They had a lot of adaptations and rewrites.
They did. And in addition, who got to sit where? Yeah. So a young African-American would not be allowed to sit in the front row because, as you could see from the playbills from Charleston in 1805, no, and I'm quoting it, people of color are allowed in this house. So in so many ways, in terms of the performance styles, in terms of Shakespeare as a kind of rhetorical force, in terms of the audiences themselves or itself, it was radically, radically different. And again, who got to speak these words and how audiences responded is a really interesting question. And it's also kind of geographically split in a number of ways. One is Puritanical New England was not really interested in theater. It liked Shakespeare on the page, not Shakespeare on the stage. Mm-hmm. The South, on the other hand, loved Shakespeare acted. There were other highbrow, lowbrow distinctions, and it's a really complicated story, and it is a story that, your question reminds us, has not been very well told. So part of the job of scholars now is to bring that out. Steve Dickey, who's sitting here, is one of the great scholars of Shakespeare during the Civil War. And if you look at some of his work on the Folger site and elsewhere, every other soldier writing home seemed to be quoting Shakespeare. Every general inspiring troops seemed to be quoting Shakespeare. So that this was a culture that turned to Shakespeare to make sense of itself. And I'm hoping that we can become that sort of culture again.
Well, through Oscar Eustace's work, I mean, and the public, they are trying to make it very accessible and of the people. But in the same country, we have, you know, little expensive, tiny productions that you can't get into.
And it's all, you know, there are things like the Aragon Shakespeare Festival, which are turning us now through their new plan to translate Shakespeare into modern American English, something that I've written about in my hometown paper very critically and I'm skeptical about. But
I just performed in Pericles, the rewritten version.
And did it work for you?
Well, if you love Shakespeare, it's just very painful to have the plays reduced to one-syllable words. I don't care who wrote the words. I don't see how you can fix The Tempest. You know, there's nothing wrong with The Tempest.
The gentleman in the front row, a mic is about to be put in your hands.
I'd like to ask your reactions to Shakespeare finding its way into opera, into Othello, where the words are not as important as the plot, and where it's awfully difficult for a woman to sing the men's parts.
Well, I just think, who was it? Was Ken, our the president of the Board of Trustees? What is his initial? He was showing us how to be or not to be. Every line of that has engendered an entire book. You know, every phrase of the monologue, to be or not to be. So the amount of other works that have been inspired, you know, ballets and operas, are testament to the power of the stories. Or, for instance, I know Othello by heart, so when I saw it in the Czech Republic, I could understand every cut. I mean, I've played Iago twice, and I've directed it, so I know the play. Mm. So when they cut something or add something, like the clown, I can hear it. And I can hear when they change the pentameter. Do you know what I mean? Because they have different translators, and I met the best translator in the world in Prague, and I also think a very bad translator. So, you know, there's all sorts of ways to go at it. It's a little bit like when people ask me, so when you do cross-gender Shakespeare, can a woman play Hamlet as a woman? I'm like, well, you could do anything you want. If you're asking me about my aesthetic, you know, but of course you can make operas and musicals and translations and rewrites and adaptations and, you know, R&J instead of Romeo and Juliet. There's so much work that comes out of this. But I think you get inspired by great work. I mean, when I need to think creatively, I usually have to create a space where there's great music or great art, or I'm in nature. That's how I would push reset if I was stressed. I would go outside and look at the ocean. And I think when people hear Shakespeare, they're inspired to come up with all kinds of new work.
especially great artists.
Great artists. Yeah. Almost no speeches ever get... Oh, I never see a movie that they don't drop into some Shakespeare just to legitimize the whole project.
Let's take a question from this side of the room, gentlemen.
I've got one right here.
Good.
I just want to say thank you both for this talk this evening. Mr. Shapiro, I had the honor of working with you in New York on a production of Antony and Cleopatra. I think you're a brilliant guy.
My question is... That was what, Terrell's?
It was Darko Trezniak's...
Of course.
Antony and Cleopatra.
Of course.
Yeah,
I remember that well. For theater, for a new audience.
For a new audience, yes. Anyway, my question is, I've read your book, Contested Will. I've actually used it to settle many an argument over the authorship debate. And I noticed that you let it slide tonight, and I wonder, did you have that conversation over pastries, or do you just not pick that fight anymore?
You know, it's always a tricky business when you raise... You could talk about Trump, but it's more dangerous talking about the Shakespeare authorship controversy. You know? And I'll just explain, for those who are less familiar with the book, that production was a lot of fun, and I miss Darko, too. I wrote a book about the Shakespeare authorship controversy, not because I'm interested in who wrote Shakespeare. I know who wrote Shakespeare. I'm interested in a couple things. One, why smart people say dumb things and think dumb things. And we all work with those people. We know them. And the other is, when I wrote that book in 2010, I was sensing that this was a culture moving towards a level of comfort with conspiracy thinking and fake news, and the willingness to accept untruths. And it was something that was permeating the culture. And I'll give you a good example that I shared with my students on Monday. After the book came out, I got a letter from Washington, D.C., from the Supreme Court of the United States. And my initial reaction was, I have to go there for jury duty? I can't believe it. It's okay, it wasn't jury duty. I opened the letter, and it was from Justice Stevens, great liberal jurist. Now, I knew that the late Scalia and the current Alito also didn't believe that Shakespeare wrote Shakespeare. They had bought into it. But when a guy on my side of the 5-4 says that Shakespeare didn't write Shakespeare, it's like, say it ain't so. And he writes saying, I've looked at the signatures, and I've noticed that the person who wrote it must have been illiterate. So I'm from Brooklyn, as you know. I'm kind of straight-talking guy. And this really bothered me. So I wrote back a letter saying, with all due respect, I noticed your secretary typed the letter for you, signed your name and initialed it, so you must really understand what it means to be an illiterate guy. And I thought that was the end of it. And he wrote back a week later with a really... He's 92 at the time. I mean, it wasn't a firm Trump-like signature at that point. And he kept coming at me with new fantasies and fake news. And I said, look, your guy, I know you've been made Oxfordian of the Year, Justice Stevens, but the guy you're representing, Loney, who came up with this theory that the Earl of Oxford wrote the plays, he wrote this to promote a fundamentally anti-democratic view of the world. Top-down hierarchy. Men rule over children and wives, and rulers rule over the rest of us. And that's why Shakespeare wrote these plays, to reinforce that. You're a liberal jurist. How can you sign on to that and believe what you believe? And he said, I can keep the two apart. And I said, no, you can't, and I'm breaking up with you. So that was it. And when he passes away, may he live to be 120, I'll turn the correspondence over to the Folger Shakespeare Library so anybody interested in what other ungenerous things I said to one of the great jurists of our day can read them there. True story. Yes, please.
Hi. I'd like to, Lisa, I'd like to take the opportunity to, could you tell us a little bit about what it, when you train women to play these roles, you know, they come in without the background and just the way you stand or anything.
Yeah.
Spend a little time telling us about that.
Hi, Jean and Jack. Great supporters of the LA Women's Shakespeare Company and of me personally. So women tend to break everything. Everything is indirect. Your heart can be going one way, your wrist in another. Anything that breaks the chi flow, you can wear high heels. You can go off your voice. You can smile a lot and mask your face. And you can be going this way and that way at the same time. Nowadays, it's mostly upspeak. My name is Lisa. You know, with the young actresses, they can't claim anything. So I'm like, is it or isn't it? Help me out here. I just met you. You know. And men tend to turn their head, then turn the whole body as one, and move very directly towards the target. That's and they brilliant. Turn their head, and they turn the whole body as one. And they move very directly for a target. And then, as we said, they tend to take up a tremendous amount of space. Also, the men who are playing lovers and monsters tend to work from the waist down, so there's a lot of basket work involved. Do you know what I mean? Sort of basket work. And then in Shakespeare, you have a lot of verticality between, you know, dangling between heaven and hell. So the males who are crowned have this wedding ring to God, have this infill from the sky gods and this connection to the earth, where they can walk with this verticality and this spiritual quest, and also have the horizontality of the machinal. I want to get that girl and that money and that title. But there is sort of like the Christian cross, you know, the heart's in the middle, and they're aspiring towards grace and falling towards lust and greed while they expand or move towards something, and then, you know, seven ages of man crumble into death. So, you know, it's interesting.
That was brilliant. That was absolutely brilliant.
Thank you. So really, for the young women, they always think they're going to fail. And also, they're absolutely unwilling to hurt one another. So if they're playing Mercutio and Romeo, it just takes longer to do the fight. Because like, oh, are you okay? Did I, you know? Instead of, Icelandic cur, you know? So I think it's really useful to find language to decimate one another and then fluff people up. Because the other big thing about women is we tend to implode and blame ourselves. And the men blame everybody but themselves. That's your fault, and this is your fault. And this is not my fault, it's yours. And it's very interesting to see how quickly you can master a male monologue simply by blaming everyone else.
And be president one day.
He's a perfect example. And in the tragedies, the women characters, the female characters, when they achieve power, they're either suffocated or they commit suicide or they just fall apart in some way, they die. So when I recently played Antonia, we regendered the role in The Tempest. The only big win of doing that is at the end, Prospero forgives Antonia, and says, you know, I forgive your ambition, which was never said to a woman in the course of the canon.
That's great.
So that was an interesting
that's
experience.
Great. That's good.
But mostly it has to do with chi flow, direct energy, and having a bigger range and scope of thought. Because Hamlet has 1,500 lines, and, you know, I think Ophelia and Gertrude together have 350 lines. So there's no great arc of character development, especially if you're expected to go mad or collapse if anything interesting happens.
Next question, right here.
Okay, great. I just wanted to say, I think that what makes Shakespeare appealing to, you know, century after century is, like, I think there's this underlying subversive quality to it, that it's essentially questioning the status quo. And I think that it's important to understand who wrote the words. And I think that it is important to know what we do know about Shakespeare. He was a businessman who hoarded grain when the people in Stratford were starving. We know that his daughters were probably... Okay, the question is, there was besides the Earl of Oxford, there's Christopher Marlowe, who is very, very highly likely did not die in 1593. and his plays himself. The question is, I think that the authorship question is viable, and I think it can lend a hand towards making the plays immediate to today's time. How do you both feel about the possibility of reading into the plays that the author was indeed Christopher Marlowe?
Well, yeah. Nobody knows who wrote the plays, so the mystery is going to remain. Unless more evidence comes, nobody really knows.
Yeah, I would take a different stance. William Shakespeare of Stratford wrote the plays. Marlowe was dead in 1593 at an inn in Deptford. Those who don't believe that want to believe in make-believe. You're welcome to. It's a faith-based way of looking at the world. Right now, to me, that is a dangerous thing to do. Is your argument that Shakespeare has been and continues to be a subversive critic and artist? For many people, yes. For other people, he's an extremely conservative one. I don't know what Shakespeare's politics were. I do know who wrote the plays, and I know who didn't. And if you want to go down that road, think of the larger risks for this culture in which you can make up stories that are not grounded in evidence. That, to me, has been proven to be, of late, a really dangerous thing. It's no longer a parlor game, folks. Next question.
Hi, I think...
Two more questions. You only get to ask one of them, however.
I'll do my best. I think what's lovely about this conversation is it presumes that there's relevance to Shakespeare's plays for our audiences today, and that it opens discussion around so many social issues that have been mentioned just over the course of this discussion. But as someone who's worked at a major Shakespeare festival and have been a part of the committees that were looking at choosing Shakespeare's plays, I know that the question of whether or not they are appropriate or can be done in today's age comes under constant fire from liberals, from the left. And I'm wondering what you say to that in the face of really comments that Lisa's made about, you know, the arc of women, about the lack of roles of women. Obviously, for so many liberals, there's problems with Othello, with Merchant of Venice, with any of the female characters in the plays. This is not my view, but I'm curious to hear how you respond to, quote unquote, our own friends about Shakespeare's ability to be performed today.
Well, I spend a lot of time advocating for women and people of color to be in the Helmer's position, because I think you have to put the interpretation of plays like Henry V and Taming of the Shrew and Othello into the hands of the people who are victimized in the story. I mean, if you're going to have a white man directing an all-female multicultural Taming of the Shrew, you won't get the same understandings as if I direct it. Do you know what I mean? So we all have a place at the table unless we don't have a place at the table, which is what Jim's point is. Who gets to do it? I mean, you know, I just did a radical reimagining of Macker's where I got rid of the three bearded witches and put Satan in the play. I'm like, if you want to trace evil, let's go down to the man downstairs. Do you know what I mean? Like, I forget about the bearded women and trying to please King James with how dangerous women are. You're talking about evil. So, you know, you can adapt something radically. When Darko did Two Noble Kinsmen, it was the first time I saw it. It was the first time I saw, oh my God, there's a lesbian in Shakespeare. I didn't even know that. Do you know what I mean? That the two noble kinsmen kill themselves over a gay woman that they see out the window that's never met them, that they've never met. So the objectification of women in your hands would be much more interesting. Do you know? Because you would know what that felt like. In my view, I would imagine you would know more about what that feels like. Do you know what I mean? But I also feel like a person, like James or myself, who spent decades looking at Shakespeare, will be the better director for the play, regardless of gender, because they're going to understand how many portals and windows are in that play to a contemporary production. Because I was reading to Mr. Shapiro a review I read of Oscar Eustace's 1991 Julius Caesar that he did here at the Taper, where he compared monarchies and republics in such a way that, you know, Brutus and Cassius look good. Do you know what I mean? So there's all kinds of intelligent directions of plays that I see. Just if I see another Love's Labors of boys in golf shorts, like, what do you think this play is about? It's a great war between the Catholics and the Protestants, and It's just there's a lot of research involved in doing a play well for the time that it's in. So, you know, it's a long answer, but yeah, I think you have to move the Helmers.
It's a great answer, and I can't really improve on it. I can only add an anecdote. We don't do a very good job in this country of talking with each other about the things about which we most disagree. And for reasons unclear to me, but for which I'm very grateful, Shakespeare allows us, across the cultural divide, across right, left, Republicans and Democrats, everyone loves Shakespeare. And he has to be utilized to engage those issues that you rightly find troubling. Anti-Semitism, racism, sexism, who gets to speak Shakespeare? Those are the things that we need to work out. And there will be no rest in this country until we figure out how to work them out. Shakespeare can play that role. Last question.
Hi, my name is Julia Weissen, and we are here from the Los Angeles Drama Club, which is the country's youngest Shakespeare troupe. And you've been speaking about who gets to speak Shakespeare and looking forward and wanting him to continue to be relevant. I would like to hear some of your thoughts about introducing Shakespeare to young people, having people grow up with Shakespeare and absorb him so that by the time they get to college, they're not meeting him fresh. He's already a friend of theirs.
Let me speak first, and then you get the last word.
Sure.
I had the worst junior high school Shakespeare teacher in America, bar none. I never took a college Shakespeare course because I hated Shakespeare so much. And my experience was watching great actors play Shakespeare, and that was my education. But like a drug dealer standing in a schoolyard handing out free samples, I decided to, once I was a professor, to go back into fourth grade classrooms and get them addicted to Shakespeare rather than turned off to it. And I can't think of anything more important in our culture than getting kids not just to read Shakespeare, but to get them on their feet and act Shakespeare. And that, I think, is the most empowering thing I've ever done in my life, is working with 11-year-olds and discovering boys, girls. The girls all were better at memorizing than the boys, so the Romeo we did had a girl playing Romeo, Mercutio, Benvolio. The boys just wanted weapons, and they were happy. And they were happy. And by the end of a month with Act 3, Scene 1, everybody knew the scene by heart. And for those of you who teach Shakespeare, don't teach the whole play. Teach a scene. And if those kids own the scene, they'll own the play. And if they own the play, they'll own 36 more plays. You get the last word on this one, Lisa.
Well, that's true. And also to see each other on stage, like the Fall Festival at Shakespeare and Company, all the residencies in 18 high schools, they come together and they celebrate by playing their plays for each other, not competing for prizes, but celebrating together in this explosion. And I just wanted to say, you know, I played Iago and directed Othello for Harlem Shakespeare with an all-female production. And, you know, I'm putting together this whole production in 10 days, staged the whole thing for one event. And it was Harlem. It was a completely different audience. It was in a university. And, you know, maybe a third of the audience came 20 minutes late, because I just didn't know that you don't start at 8 o'clock. You start at 8:30 if you say 8 o'clock. I didn't know, right? I didn't know that you got paid in packets because the actors don't have checking accounts. So they don't have enough money. Do you know, you get little cash at the Denny's, do you know what I mean? So things I didn't know. I also didn't know that they would shout their delight throughout the entire show and go, oh, no, you didn't. You get away from that bad. You bad. Oh, that's bad. And I didn't know that when I went down to my dressing room and I put my little things in my plastic carry bag and I'm done with this offer and went upstairs, that that audience would stay for 2 hours. They had to turn the lights out on the building. They were so proud of this all female company in Harlem throwing down excellent classical work that they got together as a community and they raised money to put that whole production on. Do you know what I mean? And they're doing their Black Sable series of black actors doing Shakespeare. So whether it's kids or older people, if you're not going to put them on stage, they won't come back. Do you know what I mean? Can't get the great white hope teaching artists to go into the black part of town and be the great white saviors. They don't need you. They don't want you. They didn't invite you there. Do you know what I mean? But if you can move back and forth and be inclusive on both sides, if your board and your staff are diverse, do you know? And if you include children in your productions, and if you have, you know, not just here's how you do Shakespeare correctly, but come backstage and meet the scenic artist. Come backstage and meet the stage manager. You know, spend a day in costumes. Spend a day with the actors. There's a lot that kids can get turned on to. Do you know what I mean? And also, having language in a time of tweets is really, really life-saving.
On that note, it's been thrilling to be on stage with
Thank
Lisa.
You
Thank you for all coming. That was great. That was
Thank
great.
You.
It was really great.
What an honor. Thank you.
Oh, thank you.
Oh, yay. Thank you.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, Sharon Oxborough, the estate of Suzanne Aaron, Donna and Martin J. Wolfe, Julia Meltzer, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM. Music by Boya Pongo. Support these free programs by becoming a member of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Visit lfla.org for more information. 17.